You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. HuntStand is the most popular and functional mobile hunting app on the market. With a variety of base maps to choose from, satellite imagery that is updated every month, the ability to check the weather, know property information, and even catalog your trail cam pics, HuntStand even gives you the ability to import pins and location markers from other mobile apps. Visit HuntStand.com or download wherever you download your apps. Enter discount code SN20 at checkout for 20% off. Interstate Batteries offers a wide variety of batteries for your everyday needs. Stop into one of their thousands of retail locations and talk with a battery specialist about batteries for your truck, trail cameras, and even those weird batteries for your rangefinder. Interstate Batteries even offers cell phone repair in certain locations. For more information, visit interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This is the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, brought to you by Vortex Optics. Here we go again, ladies and gentlemen. Hopefully everybody's having a great week. It is Wednesday. No, well, today is Tuesday. When you're listening to this, it will be a Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday. And hopefully everybody's having a good week. I got a big check mark. There was a lot of stress in our family from the accident that my wife was in. And one of the stressors was that now we only have one vehicle, right? And my wife isn't cleared to drive yet. With that said, yesterday we got a vehicle. We bought a vehicle. And so this vehicle that I bought, and I know I joked about it in one of the episodes that I did with Tony Peterson, but it sounds to me like my wife's happy with it. And so I think the way that this summer and off season is going, and the fact that the kids are going to be in school this fall, and my youngest is going to be in full-time daycare for pretty much the entire day, and there's going to be activities to keep the kids busy, man, I really think that I'm going to be able to get out and hunt as much as I want to this year. Now, with that said, I absolutely love going and participating in my kids' events, right? Whether that's baseball or soccer or football or dance, like whatever it is, I love to be a part of that. I love to go watch and even coach and things like that. So with all that said, I think I'll be able to get out a lot this year. My wife, you know, obviously things change, but I think my wife's in a good mood. And I think that if I can continue keeping her in a good mood, some of that's me, right? I'm responsible for some of that. Some of that's her, and some of that's my kids, which they're the wild card in this whole situation. Who knows what the hell they're going to do. But I think if all things go in the right direction, I really think that I'll be able to get away with a lot of time in the stand this year. The issue with that is, can I afford it? And I actually talk a little bit about this in this episode today. We got the host of the Truth from the Stand podcast. You guys have probably heard it, Clint Campbell. And we talk about this whole inflation deal and how that's going to affect our upcoming hunting season. And man, if these gas prices keep going up like they're predicted to do, if we have $5 gas, $6 gas, who knows where it's going to go, right? But if it's going to be high this time next, during the hunting season, man, I might have to cut one, if not two, out-of-state trips off and just stick with South Dakota and that's it. I really wanted to get to Nebraska this year. I really wanted to get to Oklahoma, maybe Missouri this year. And I don't think those are going to happen strictly because of the cost of everything. I wish I could sit here and say, I'm so successful that money isn't an option. It's an, it, I got to think about it, right? It goes into everything that we, everything. Shit, we usually spend $200 a week on groceries before this inflation kind of hit. And now we're spending $300 to $400. That is ridiculous for a family of five. And so I'm the most asshole-ish, frugal person that there is. My wife hates me for that sometimes, but man, you got to feed the family and you got to pay the bills before you go on the hunting trips. And I'm just lucky that I have the access, you know, the funds to get away with some of that stuff. But man, it's ridiculous out there. And we talk a little bit about that today, man. We talk about, this is just a straight up BS session. We talk a lot about out-of-state hunts. We talk about wind mapping. We talk about how deer use their nose to travel terrain. We talk, what's cool about this episode is we get into examples of different scenarios and how they worked or how they didn't work. We both share examples and experiences of us failing. We both share examples of scouting techniques and hunting strategy techniques that I think you guys are going to enjoy. And it's a really fun episode. Let me see here. I have a couple things already written down. How we pick our out-of-state hunts, wind mapping during the off season, and if that will help during the hunting season, and why I'm a huge fan of Bo Jackson, the football player / baseball player, Bo Jackson. He's like my childhood idol. And if anybody knows him, I would love to interview him. I wish I could have Bo Jackson on this podcast. And I think I'd do a good job interviewing him. But with that said, so Bo Jackson, if you're listening, hit me up, dog. Other than that, awesome episode coming your way. Now we do have to, I'm just going to mention some partners here real quick. If you're looking for a saddle, there's obviously one saddle company. There's more than one saddle available, but if you want one of the best on the market, I mean, I've just been pressured by this community to try to pick up a saddle this year and give it a shot. And that's why I went with Tethered. Tethered, it has been around for a while. It's the company that really brought a spotlight, in my opinion, back to saddle hunting. It was a fad a long time ago, and I think Tethered kept it from being a fad again and actually making it a legit, like, just as popular as tree stands, right? So huge shout out to Tethered for working with me this year. I think you guys are going to enjoy some of the content that's going to be coming out of the Tethered camp here on the Nine Finger Chronicles. Wasp Broadheads, wasparchery.com. Dude, love the people that work for this company. Fred Doherty, if you're listening, man, you're the shit. And so I love working with that company. Awesome broadheads. A majority of their heads are made in America with some of the best material possible. And that means that when that broadhead hits what it's supposed to hit, and even on a marginal shot, it's going to do a ton of damage. And that's what you want for your broadheads. Wasparchery.com. And there is a discount code, and that discount code, I think, is NFC20 for 20% off, I think, or 9FC. It's either NFC. This is shitty of me not knowing this. 9FC20 or NFC20. Try them both and then let me know what works. Excalibur crossbows. If you're looking for a crossbow from a company that's been around for a long time, check out excaliburcrossbow.com. Tons of options to choose from. Obviously, this is the when I'm on my phone right now, whether I'm on the toilet taking a dump or I'm waiting on my wife or kids, or like tonight when I go to dance, I'm going to be on my phone or on my desktop version of Hunt Stand, and I'm just going to be scouring access routes. I'm going to be looking at public land options in different states. I'm going to see where the access is, food, water, all that stuff just through e-scouting. I'm going to be able to journal everything that I find. And then when I'm out there, I can go reference it and basically fact check those areas. And Hunt Stand allows me to do that along with a ton of other functionality. And I got a discount code for Hunt Stand. It's only $30 a year, but you can get 20% off by entering the discount code SN20. Then we have Vortex Optics. Man, if you want a company that's makes excellent optics, but is also run by excellent people. I mean, of all the companies that I've ever worked with throughout the years of doing what I've been doing, I know and keep in touch with more people from Vortex than any other company that I've ever worked with or have met. So huge shout out to Vortex for making excellent products and having excellent people. And all that does is translate into excellent customer service. And they have that VIP warranty to back it up. So vortexoptics.com, go check out their website. And lastly, we got exodusoutdoorgear.com. I think these guys are coming out. They're a trail camera company for the most part, but now they're expanding and they're getting into arrows as well. I don't know if they're out 100% yet, but keep an eye out. I think Exodus is dropping some custom arrows as well. So cool things coming from Exodus. Other than that, man, thanks for taking time to listen to those commercials, because they allow me to do what I do when they pay me. So if you guys are looking for really high quality brands, man, anything that I just mentioned, Tethered, Wasp, Excalibur, Hunt Stand, Vortex, Exodus, man, please go out and support those brands. Let them know that you heard their, you know, me talk about them on this podcast. And what that does is it just verifies them, right? If you ever are on the phone with them or you're ever leaving a message for them from them, just say, hey man, you're working with the Nine Finger Chronicles. That dude's legit. And so, thank you for doing so. That would mean a lot to me. Good podcast coming your way, guys. Hopefully you guys are enjoying the spring. Dude, it's almost summertime. Kids are almost out of school. It's time to get the bows out. It's time to start looking at the gear. And we got a lot of content coming in this summer. Probably looks like it's going to be pushed back to the late June, July timeframe, definitely into August. And as all of the content starts coming in, for the hunting season as well, man, it's going to be one hell of a summer. You guys definitely need to pay attention about what's going on here. So let's get into today's podcast with my man, Clint Campbell from Truth from the Stand. 3, 2, 1. All right, everybody. Once again, we have Clint Campbell from Truth from the Stand podcast here. And, like I said before we started recording, man, I have absolutely nothing planned or scheduled to talk about on this episode.
That's awesome, man. I love these sessions, man, where you just kind of go wherever the conversation happens to take you. You're getting me at my best time too, man. We got the early morning record session going on, so this is before like the day's work fog has set in.
Yes. Yes.
And I've run out of F's to give. Like you got me with a full tank of F's. How's that?
Oh, that's great, man. So it's almost like I take a little bit of priority out of your day today.
Exactly. Dan, you are my priority today, man.
Oh, I appreciate that. That makes me feel good about myself.
Right. Well, there you go, man. Well, that's the thing, dude. Like we always got to be there to pick each other up, man.
That's right.
You know, that's the deal. Not just hunters, but podcasters. It's a grind.
Yeah,
you know, every now and then. It's funny, man, because you know, there's sometimes, you know, you've been doing this for a long time, and I think I'm coming up on my 6-year anniversary of having the podcast, and there's still days where I'm just like, man, I suck at this.
I try not to think about things like that, especially when it comes to, like, I don't know about you, but when you're recording a podcast and at the end of it, you leave it and you go, dude, I just crushed that one. Like I nailed that interview. I asked all the right questions, blah, blah, blah. And then there's other ones. I had one last week where I had mumble mouth and I was like just tripping over my words. And it sounded great, but it came out, you know, all mumbly and when you have to end a question with, you know what I mean? And they're like, I think so.
Right. So you're not sure that you understand the question and you ask it.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. In my head, it's perfect. But when it came out of my mouth. Yeah.
Yeah, totally been there, dude, for sure.
Yeah.
I find that, like, you know, I've had a couple guys on recently where I've purposefully kind of gotten out of my comfort zone and had some folks on who weren't, I mean, hunting related, but it wasn't a hunting specific conversation.
Yeah.
And so you're trying to balance walk the tightrope of not sounding like a complete idiot, but being there to like also learn at the same time. Like I was talking to this dude, Kevin Estella, who is a survival expert, and a wilderness expert, of which I am neither, you know. It's like, I'm a hunter. And I was reading his book. And so I was trying not to sound like a fanboy, like, oh, this is so cool. You know, yeah. You know what I mean? So yeah. Trying to figure out how to ask the right questions and learn, but not come off like a complete chode, which I don't know that I achieved either of those things.
We'll right. See. Yeah. It's, I don't go out and interview. I mean, on this podcast, I'm like, I don't know what episode I'm coming up on, but it's like 700. Okay. Right. And so I have 700 episodes and I'm going to say under 20 times in 700 episodes where I feel like I've interviewed an industry, I guess, let's just say a hunting industry icon or a big dog in that. Most of the conversations I've had have just been with regular people, people who have found success doing what they do their own way. And so I don't ever really get nervous, but like, and it, here's the other thing. It's hard because if I could interview any person in that hunts, it would be my childhood icon, Bo Jackson. You know, running back for Oakland or LA and baseball player for Kansas City and, you know, all like that Bo Jackson.
Yep.
And so he's a big archer and bow hunter and things like that. And so if I could interview anybody, it'd be him. But I think I've reached out to him for like 2 years now straight and no response. So I need,
that's crazy, man. I would have never guessed. If I were to guess, if someone told me to bet any amount of money that was important to me and take a wild guess as to who Dan Johnson's childhood hunting idol was, I in a million years would have never guessed Bo Jackson.
Yeah.
And he is a huge archer, like a huge hunter.
Yeah. I don't know if he's necessarily like a hunting icon to me, but he is a icon to me as far as, you know, sports and just like my youth, right? When I was young, I thought Bo Jackson was the, like, he for me, he ranked above Michael Jordan. He ranked above anybody ever. And so Bo Jackson was it for me, especially the dude was on a video game and he was unstoppable, right?
Yeah. 100%, man. I played the bejesus out of that game. And it's funny that you mentioned Bo Jackson, because literally my dad, he retired at the end of April and he sold his place in the Carolinas and moved back to Pennsylvania. He has a cabin in the woods that he built. It's not a cabin, it's a house. He calls it a cabin.
Yeah.
He's now in the process of like, hey, here's all the shit that you still had at my house.
Oh,
like,
yes.
Why don't you take all this crap, you know?
Yep.
And so I was going through it and there was like boxes upon boxes of baseball and football cards that I came across. And I had a bunch of like old Bo Jackson cards. Actually had some like old, like E. Henderson rookie card. Like as I was going through it, looking them up, I was like, damn, I was like, I've got like actually some money like laying in this old box.
Yeah.
Which was kind of cool.
Yeah. I'll tell you this, man. My dad from 1986 to about 1996, he bought me a full set of baseball cards every single year, right? And in that full set are every rookie that comes through in that time frame. And so, dude, I have thousands of baseball cards and comic books sitting in a box at my dad's house. And when my kids get old enough to where they don't use them as, you know, the clothespin on the bicycle spokes, right?
Yeah.
So yeah. My dad is saving them all for me at his place. I'd love to go through and check and see who's there, dude. Like Frank Thomas, he was huge. He was huge back then. And I have tons of his rookie cards.
Yeah, you're going to have a ton of really good, like, that's an era of players that came in during that time that are, like, you know, like Bonds was in around that area, as well. You know, that would be a great card to have. I don't remember what year his rookie year was. It might have been 86.
Yeah, I don't know.
Any early Bonds record or any early Bonds card is going to be worth some coin.
Yeah, absolutely. this, I don't know why this popped in my head, but that's the roid era, right? Just like everybody's juiced to the gills. And, and so, how crazy would it be if like the hunting industry took that same approach to whether or not a trophy was legal or not? And it's just like breaking news. So-and-so tests positive for steroids after they killed a record book buck. And then they're just completely shamed and they can't put it in a book and things like that. I don't know why, but that would be hilarious.
Yeah. Well, what popped into my head immediately was like, what if they all walked around just like super jacked, like just giants, you know what I mean? Like, you see, you know, I don't know, Lee Lukoski, and he's like, he's just like yoked.
Yeah, like, I don't know. He's kind of tall. I think he's like probably 6'2 or something like that, but just like 250, just lats out, can't even put his arms down. I don't know. That's funny.
Yeah, it'd be awesome.
All right. So I want to talk to you a little bit about this economy that we're in right now, right? And how it's going to affect your hunts this year. So usually I mean, the past 2 years I've gone out and I've done two, sometimes three out-of-state trips in a given hunting season. Gas prices are up. Yeah. Everything's up, right? And so I don't know what your situation is, but I'm considering having to drop one, if not two, of my out-of-state hunts this year.
Yeah. No, it's funny you mentioned that because I was having a similar thought. This is probably, I don't know, maybe 2 months ago or so. I'm kind of locked in for the Idaho hunt because that I already have a tag for that, kind of a done deal. But, you know, I did decide that I'm going to fly because it's actually probably not much more expensive for me just to take the flight than it is for me to actually drive based on gas prices now.
Yeah.
So I'm going to fly that trip. Where it's coming into play for me was actually more around, like, my friends all make fun of me because I'm a tight ass with money. Like, I just am, you know what I mean? Like, I like it to see it leave my wallet. Some of it was around scouting and just trying to bundle scouting trips in with other kind of trips to kind of kill two birds with one stone. So the one piece that I'd been scouting the big woods in the northeastern part of PA, you know, typically I would make a couple of trips up, and I made one up in, I guess over the winter, I made a trip up and did some scouting before things got completely buck wild. And then once everything kind of got buck wild, I was planning to make probably two, three more trips potentially. And what I ended up doing was scrapping those trips and ended up just doing like a turkey camp up there to make one trip up. And then I stayed for like 3 days. And, you know, in PA, you can only hunt till noon, spring gobbler, like the first 2 weeks. So I'd hunt till noon Saturday, then scout in the afternoon and all day Sunday. I can't hunt on Sunday, so I scouted all day Sunday. And then, you know, Monday, same thing, hunted in the morning and then scouted in the afternoon. And basically got the rest of my cameras out and the stuff that I needed to get done. That was kind of the big change because my plan was to spend a lot of time up there this year. And it's just, you know, it's not a far drive, but when I'm pulling my DIY trailer and it's 2.5 hours, I mean, it's a $150 trip, most likely, you know, round trip, if not a little bit more on average. Like, that was with the old gas prices. So, you know, tack on, you know, another $2.50 per gallon, roughly, you know, for that trip. So that was one thing that it definitely changed. The other thing that it changed was that before, you know, things got completely buck wild, or I ended up kind of putting in for Kansas again this year, and I don't have any points. You know, I'm just going to see if I can draw it. And, you know, I love, you know, I had a great experience in Kansas last year, and it became one of my favorite places to hunt out of all the places that I've been. And, you know, so I definitely want to go back and try to redeem myself, you know, on screwing up a couple opportunities there. But, you know, I'd be lying if I said that I was 100% hoping that I draw that tag, because there's a little part of me in the back of my mind that's going, man, it would be kind of nice if you didn't draw that tag this year, because that's going to be an expensive gas trip pulling the trailer out. And I could just spend the year hunting, you know, that northern big woods piece and kind of focus that. And it'd still be a travel hunt because it's a couple hours away from my house. So I still get a little bit of adventure, but don't have to spend all the money to get out to Kansas and do that hunt. So you know, I'm kind of locked in. If I draw it, I'm going to have to go. I'm not going to eat a tag just, you know, because of the gas prices and stuff like that. But, you know, in the back of my mind, there's a part of me that just kind of hopes that it'd be cool if this year, if I didn't draw that tag, I'd be okay with that.
Yeah. This is the first year I've ever put in for Kansas, and I kind of knew going into it that with my schedule, I just went ahead and bought the preference point instead of applying for the actual tag. So next year, I think, might be my first year ever in Kansas. So we'll see what it brings, but I'm kind of glad it worked out instead of applying for one. I just went the preference point route and hoping that maybe next year things calm down, man. I don't know. It's like, I just keep seeing things go up and up and up and up, and you know, groceries doubled, and my wife got an accident recently, and so yesterday we bought a new car, and of course it's not the equal car to what we purchased or that we had. It's the step up and up, so now we have a car payment again, and so it's so gross. Yeah. Like, money is so gross. I like having it, but I don't, like you, I don't like spending it or talking about it or watching like anything about it, really.
Yeah. Yeah. And to your point, it's like, I don't know that I see an end in sight. You know, I would like to think, you know, we, you know, in a year, you know, or a year from now, or a year from the fall, or hopefully sooner, but just, you know, be a little bit more pessimistic or optimistic, however you want to look at it. You know, that, you know, a year from now that things feel a little bit, you know, feel a little bit better. But as things are kind of going, it's like every time you look at the news, it's like there's something else completely ridiculous and stupid that feels like it's out of a freaking movie. You know what I mean? That you're watching.
Right. It's
like, oh, cool. So monkeypox, that's awesome.
I was just going to say that.
You know, and then you got, you know, like, we're starting to trade barbs with China, you know, also, which is like, I don't know if you want to play that F around and find out award, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
right.
They're not the most tightly wrapped crew is what I gather, you know, but who knows, man. I mean, people that make a lot more money than me, and you would hope are smarter than me, are making those decisions. But I think it, history, if we use it as our barometer, maybe I should be making the decisions. I probably can't do any worse.
Right. Exactly. You know, you ever been into like a local bar and you hear two drunks just, you know, they've been there since the bar opened, and they're just sitting there going, well, if I was president, I'd do this. You know what? I think we should just put one of those guys in charge sometime and just kind of just see, because it really can't get any worse, really. I mean, we could probably, you know, that guy gets cocky and says, well, I'm gonna launch nukes at, you know, Guatemala or whatever, you know. And okay, buddy, all right, well, we won't actually launch nukes, but we will do this idea. Okay, cool. You know, like there would be a couple fail safes put in place, but the drunk guy at the bar probably has some good ideas. Maybe
he might have some good ideas. I used to always refer to them, not necessarily the bar folks, but, you know, people who sit around coffee shops and solve problems all day, every day. I always referred to them as coffee shop prophets.
Yeah.
That was like my term for them. I would be bartending at a bar, and there would be some you know, skinny jeans person come in. It's like going to tell me like how the world works. I'm like, cool, man, like drink another latte, solve some more problems, buddy.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. You know. I don't know. I'm in that place right now where I'm just like, hey, let's give it a try. You know, it can't really hurt that bad, could it?
Right. Yeah, exactly. What, gas is going to be $7 a gallon? Cool.
Yeah, right. Right. Oh, but buddy.
What about you, man? So you have, what trips you have planned this year?
Well, right.
And what do you have on your docket that you feel pretty confident that you're going to be on?
So here, like, I already have my tag for South Dakota, right? Mm-hmm. But Nebraska is over the counter. Oklahoma's over the counter. So there's two more tags that are potentially on the chopping block that I had planned. Like, if you were to ask me 4 months ago or at the beginning of the year, those are Oklahoma and Nebraska were locked in along with South Dakota. But I already applied for my South Dakota tag. It should be coming in the mail here pretty soon. And that's a guaranteed, because I have the tag. but right. I also make a trip. Last year, I made a trip out to Nebraska in September, and I did the an early season hunt there, tagged out in South Dakota in October, dropped back down to Nebraska for a handful of days to try to get it done there. But I wanted to add Oklahoma, first time ever hunting down there. And so Nebraska and Oklahoma are now on the balance beam, basically. They could, it could fall anyway. You know, I, honestly, if gas prices go up, probably not going to go. I usually sleep in my truck or get, for the most part, really cheap hotel rooms. My South Dakota right. trip is going to be a pack-in hunt this year. So I'll park at a trailhead and then walk like a mile and a half, 2 miles in, set up, and then go from there. But the other two, I kind of have stopped planning and looking at them at this point right now. I kind of know where I want to go, but I also don't want to put too much more effort into it if I know that prices are going to either remain the same or go up. I mean, they'd have to go, gas prices would have to probably go down a little bit for me in order to make both of those trips happen, right? So right now, I'm probably just going to choose one, Nebraska or Oklahoma, but gas prices would have to go down for me to choose both.
Yeah, it's I'm just curious, like, how much I'll be curious to see, like, the tag numbers next year.
Yeah.
Or, like, the states that are just that get a lot of out-of-state traffic.
Right.
You know, like, the destination states. Like, essentially, anywhere in the Midwest that, you know, has a lot of out-of-state hunters, you know, as part of their, you know, I guess, tag purchasing.
Yeah.
I would have to guess that it's going to go down. I think what you might see more of would be my guess, because I even thought of this. I was like, well, maybe I don't draw Kansas this year. You know, or maybe I get lucky and I don't. If I really, really want to make a little trip, you know, maybe I tag out in PA, I was like, maybe I'll just jump back over to the spot I like to hunt in Ohio.
Yeah.
You know, something that's a little closer, not an 18-hour drive or 20-hour drive for me. You know, still cost a little bit in gas and stuff like that, but it's a little bit more doable. I was like, I just kind of stay closer to home and maybe I head down to like Maryland or Delaware or something like that and go to a state that I typically wouldn't hunt.
Right.
You know what I mean? And just, you know, cause it's only a couple hours from home and do that. But yeah, I mean, I think it probably has probably cramped a lot of people's hunting plans, I would say. You know, yeah. I'm also looking at it through the lens of, man, I'm glad I don't have to put any food plots in this year. Cause I really don't want to pay. I'm glad I'm not paying for diesel.
Oh, diesel and fertilizer. If you're a fertilizer guy.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. The, you know, what you were saying there about, man, I just kind of lost my train of thought, but I knew what I was going to say. Preference points, right? Mm-hmm. So, I have an elk tag. So not last year, but the year before, I bought a preference point based, or I have like, 7 years worth of preference points for Wyoming elk and Wyoming antelope. And, I think 5 or 6 now for deer out there. And so the year COVID was really bad, the draw odds went down, or excuse me, they went up. So the number of preference points that I had would have got me 100% draw. The next year I actually applied thinking that was going to hold true for the next year. It went up 3 preference points. So all these people are sitting on preference points. They decided not to go. I wonder if this year is going to be similar. I wish I would have now applied this year.
Right.
And now next year I'll probably apply for that elk tag in Wyoming. And now it's just going to jump up again. So I'm just going to be chasing my tail the whole time, trying to get into these spots.
Yeah, that's a good point. Cause I know, I know like Kansas, for example, is a good example where a lot of folks, if you have 1 point, you're pretty well guaranteed Kansas tag. And it was even previously, if you didn't have any points, like you, depending on what unit you were going to, like you still had a pretty good chance. It wasn't exactly over the counter, but it was about as good as you could get for a draw state.
Yeah.
You know, close to over the counter kind of purchasing, you know, I guess it'd be one way to say it. And from what I've heard, it's kind of similar to you, is that, you know, guys that used to kind of draw that state pretty regularly with no points, like just there's no shot anymore to do that, you know, which I guess I'll find out this year. And I know even prior, I think two things happened, at least in my guesstimation, is that prior to COVID and all that stuff, travel hunting became more popular.
Yes.
Right? Like people, you know, were more interested in it. It seemed like it was more feasible. Guys like me, you, the guys from the hunting public, whatever, talking about travel hunting and stuff like that, it just made it more accessible for people. It's like, hey, this is something I could do. And then you tag on like the idea of COVID and, you know, people, you know, wanting to prioritize experiences because it changed how they thought about life or the world or whatever the case is. So I think those two things together kind of has made it harder to draw states. Cause I know even when I went to Iowa, I drew with 4 points.
Yeah.
And I know that same year, I think Andy May was trying to draw and he didn't draw, like, and I think he had 5 points.
Yeah.
You know, so I just kind of got lucky that year. And so I think just overall draw states are becoming harder to draw for a number of reasons, you know, which kind of brings me to the point that I was going to make, like, you know, one thing that I did this year was I actually, you know, because I want to just try to hunt a bunch of different places and see as much as I can possibly see, I actually got in with like a company that actually will manage my points for me. So Essentially they make a hunt plan for me.
Yeah.
And I sit down with them and I basically outline, like, these are the states and the species that I want to hunt. And, you know, they kind of map out a roadmap and say, all right, you know, we're going to be able to do this in this many years. And it basically takes 3 years for me to start to gain enough points. And then I'm able to basically draw a different state every year, like after the third year in perpetuity,
yeah,
for a species that I want to chase in a really, really good unit. Still all public land. It's like, it's no outfitters or anything like that. But it's just kind of mapping out a roadmap so I can go see the places that I want to go see. Because one of the places I really want to go to was the Breaks in Montana.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I'm never going to do that if I try to manage all these points on my own and try to get a good mule deer unit in Colorado and try to get to Wyoming. And, you know, so I was like, you know, I either just need to, you know, work with somebody who has way better knowledge of like the units, and I don't have the time to always do all the investigating for all these states. I was like, why not just, you know, purchase a hunt plan, you know, and I think it's something like $400, and they manage all my points for me and kind of make sure I meet all the application deadlines and stuff like that. And, you know, and it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. And then I know within 3 years, I'll be going to a different Western state every year after that for as long as I want to do it.
Yeah. What company is that?
I think it's called The Draw.
The Draw.
Yeah. I'm not mistaken. Super good dudes. You know, Chad actually uses them as well. And it was actually a buddy of his that he went to Idaho with last year, I believe, that has used them for, I don't even know how long. Like, this dude goes out west and kills elk every year.
Yeah.
And really good hunter. And he turned Chad onto it. And, you know, Chad and I do a fair amount of hunting together. And so he was like, hey, if we want to travel west together, he's like, I'm building a hunt plan. If we want to map our, you know, our species and our states together so we can, you know, travel together, like, you should get in on this plan. And so I called the dude up and we chatted. And the cool thing was, is I'm still managing like all my whitetail stuff because I know the places I want to go there. And it's not nearly as daunting as it is trying to manage Western points and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Western hunts.
Yeah.
But the one thing he does do is, like, there's this little hidey hole in Texas that he knew about that is public land, but it's by permit only. And it's in a baller spot that has just hammers, and they only allow, I want to say something like, he said like 5 permits a year, and it's not super well known, but like essentially working through him, like, he can kind of navigate the backwaters that need to be navigated to try to secure me a permit.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so, yeah. So it's like things like that. Like I would do those types of things for whitetails. I can go hunt like a really interesting place that's not well known, that has, you know, really great caliber of deer and stuff like that. But by and large, I'll handle all the whitetail stuff and he'll help me handle. It's mainly antelope, mule deer, and elk is what my hunt plan consists of.
Yeah. Yeah. I have no, man, like, there's a lot of guys out there who are just like, oh, I got to shoot a moose or I got to shoot a kid. Like, for me, the only animal that I want to kill that is outside of the lower 40, well, I guess they might have some in northern Montana or something. I don't know. But before I die, I'm going to shoot a caribou, right? I'm not going to be real picky about it, but like mountain goat, bighorn sheep, like all that kind of stuff. I guess it's I'm too behind in the game to get some of those types of draws. Now I could go to Canada through an outfitter, potentially Alaska to get some of that stuff done. But again, now we're talking 10 grand a hunt and plus on some of these. And I'm just like, dude, I just want to get the, like, I just want to shoot a mule deer. I want to shoot an elk and an antelope and a caribou. And I think in the next 10 years, hopefully I can be able to, I'm able to do that in some fashion. But, I've been really close. I just, and I'm not talking about any type of trophies. I'm talking about just saying that, hey, I killed an antelope once, or I killed an elk once, or something like that. And, you know, take that experience with me and take the meat home and that kind of stuff. But, one thing that I've been personally looking at, and I haven't put this plan into action yet, and I want to hear what you have to say, is like there's states out there that non-residents can go and they can get multiple tags, right? And they can, it's not just like Iowa or Kansas where a non-resident comes here and they get their one tag. You get one buck tag. There's states out there where you can get multiple buck tags. And so I'm looking at those states less about any type of trophy size, right? I don't give a shit about antlers, but I want to go and hunt. And if I tag out on day one, guess what? I can go and potentially go hunt again. And so I would love, I'm starting to look at states like that. And a lot of those seem to be in the South where you can get multiple, you know, multiple buck tags. And I still think that from a traveling standpoint, you're not going to find the biggest deer on public land down in the South or out West in certain states, but it gives you an experience and a lot of experience if you want to, I don't know, if you want to go hunt and hunt a lot. And I think that that's kind of the direction I think I'm going to steer my ship in.
Yeah, it's funny. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think Alabama is a multiple buck state.
Oh, yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, I think Mississippi is too. Don't quote me on that one, but I'm pretty sure Alabama is. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, is Oklahoma a multiple buck state?
I think so. Yeah, I think it's either two or three.
Yeah, and one place that I really want to, well, two places I really want to go for that purpose is Oklahoma. I have a buddy who hunts a good bit in Oklahoma, so that's definitely one place I want to get to. But the one place I keep kind of coming back to for the same reason is Alabama. Because the one thing I always kind of think about is like, you know, Pennsylvania, I focus a lot on, you know, the early season and like, and pre-rut. And a lot of times around here, it's like, if it doesn't happen by then, you know, gun season coming in shortly thereafter, you know, it's going to be, you know, into late season, it's going to be really, really hard with a bow at that point.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm usually gone during the rut at some point, like during some part of early November, late October, I'm usually gone on like a trip somewhere. And so Pennsylvania is really kind of like early season through pre-rut, and then I'm usually gone. The other thing I would like to start doing is going to Alabama, because that's a state where you can catch multiple ruts.
Absolutely.
So that's the thing that I kind of look at, is like, man, it would be awesome to be able to catch like the pre-rut in PA, because I know, because I have intimate knowledge with the areas that I hunt, that I know like certain areas that turn on, you know, especially in that like October lull time period where it's like I've kind of found some hidey holes where, you know, some mature deer will start moving, especially in and around some of these community scrapes that I've found. And so my middle of October hunting around here is better than anything that I've ever had during quote unquote the rut or the beginning of November.
Yeah.
And then I can travel out of state, go to, you know, a Kansas or Ohio, or when I'm able to draw Iowa again, go back to Iowa, you know, whatever the case is during that early part of November. And then I can kind of do the, you know, Thanksgiving, Christmas with the family, stuff like that. And then I can leave and sometime in January, after I've kind of fulfilled all the family obligations, head to Alabama and catch the rut yet again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I've always kind of wanted to do that, because I was like, man, I can catch probably, if you time it right, and if you can hunt, you have a couple buck tags in Alabama, you can time it right, you can probably catch two different ruts in Alabama.
Yeah.
And so essentially hunt the rut like three different times in a year.
Yeah. And that's why I like that north-south approach where, you know, that third week in November, my uncle lives down in Kansas, and that third week in November, he says that's when the rut is on and popping down where he lives in Kansas. The second week is Iowa. And then so that first week in November, is probably just a layoff type of, because I don't know about you, but if I'm starting to go, I can come home in November for about 3 or 4 days and then leave again. And I feel like my wife would be okay with that. But if I start going 3 weeks, you know, I start doing that 3 weeks in a row, that bridge would be worn down really, like if not just straight burnt to the ground. So right. I'm trying to plan these hunts, like, which is great about September. I can throw in, let's just say all things go well, I can go September. I can hunt in September in Nebraska, take 3 weeks off, even 4 weeks, 5 weeks, go to do my South Dakota trip, come back, have one or two weeks off, then do Iowa, and then go to Oklahoma, Missouri, potentially back to, Nebraska if I don't tag out. Or the other option is hunt that first week in November, hunt Oklahoma, Missouri, Nebraska before their rifle seasons kick in, because I'm not gonna mess around with the rifle season in some of those states. Yeah. And they kick in like halfway through the month, 10 days into the month. So you can hunt the first week of the rut in those states, along with several other states before their, before their rifle season kicks in, and then come back to Iowa, hunt that third week or that second, late second, third week, and still catch the rut in Iowa. So these are all these things that I'm planning in my head. The thing that I can't get past yet, and I want to hear what you have to say about this, is my farms that I have access to in Iowa, I know when they're hot. Right. So, but I always get into them a little bit early, and it's hard for me to walk away from them. You know what I mean? Right. It's hard for me to say, I'm going to put Iowa on hold, this property that I know I can locate a deer through trail cameras. I can set up on them. Last year was a perfect example. Located a deer through trail cam, set up twice on them, killed them on the third hunt. And so I don't want to say it's like fishing a barrel, because it's not, but yeah. I feel very confident in that approach to these farms here in Iowa. It's hard for me to walk away from that and go somewhere else. What's your experience in that?
Yeah, I mean, I totally get the whole that it's hard to kind of walk away from. And, you know, PA is not Iowa. I manage to get into a couple good deer every year in around where I live on public. And, you know, I usually have three shooters to chase that'll be anywhere from, I think the biggest one locally last year was probably in the 50s, I think. Just, he was a freaky, he had like a really, he was a non-typical, and I'd never found a non-typical in all my years of hunting in Pennsylvania. I kind of happened to find one, and I hunted him. But similar to you, it's like I kind of know when my spots turn on, you know. And I really, around here, I prioritize, oddly enough, you know, that October probably 13th through like the 22nd roughly. A couple reasons is most people are out of the woods then. They aren't spending a lot of time, because they're, you know, deer aren't moving out in the open any longer, and they're not fully in like their, you know, their rut movement of kind of traveling all over creation. And so people just, you know, think that deer aren't moving. And I've just found pockets where they are. And so I kind of prioritize my hunts around those dates. Now, I totally get the whole, you know, if I have something on trail camera, or I maybe observe something from somewhere where I'm hunting and I want to make a play on it, then I'll hunt, you know, earlier in October or whatever the case is. My season comes in September 19th, roughly mid-September around here. I'm in a special regs unit, so yeah, it comes in a little bit early. But what I end up doing a lot of times during that earlier part of the year is I kind of try to stay out of, to your point, the places that I know well that are going to turn on at specific, around specific dates. And then I'll prioritize just kind of hunting maybe newer to me spots that maybe it's like, hey, this spot's a fringe of this kind of core area of this one deer that I was hunting last year. Let me kind of throw a flyer hunt at that. I want to check and see what the wind is going to do here, because I haven't completely wind mapped this. I need to know this better. So let me just go hunt this spot today. And so I do a lot of that during the early part of the season, where I'm just kind of hunting spots almost as like really super extended scouting for even the upcoming year. You know what I mean? I'll get in there and see if, you know, there's any you know, fresher sign laid down, and, you know, like I said, kind of wind map the area and figure out my access and stuff like that. And last year I did that, and, you know, had a really great encounter with a shooter, and, you know, just didn't get an arrow off. And now it's one of my spots this year that I'm like, okay, I know now better how to hunt it. And now it's kind of like one of the prime spots. I watched it with trail cameras. It's close to a big community scrape in a signpost rub, and deer are using it all year round. So it became like one of those spots now that where, you know, it's now one of the five or six spots that I have where I'm like, man, I know when this is going to turn on. I know the time frame that the does are like, there's going to be a warm doe that's in here in like around the 18th of October, you know? So I use the early part of the season to do that and kind of play the game similarly to you, where I try to stay out of my prime areas and use that earlier part of the season as almost an extended period of scouting.
Yeah. You mentioned wind mapping. I want to talk about that for a second, because that's one thing that I want to do more of, but every time I get into an area, I go scouting and I'm trying to wind map what this area does, and whether it is in March when there's no vegetation, or I'm doing it in the summer where maybe I'm trimming out a tree, or I'm going to just set sticks up, or just kind of walking through a property, and I get an idea of kind of what the wind's doing. But then November comes, and that has changed because the vegetation has changed.
Yep.
Talk to us a little bit about how you wind map areas to try to, I guess, best guess what the wind's going to be doing in those scenarios in a different time of year.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think any piece of intel you can get, you know, regardless of what time of season it is just helpful, yeah. You know, so totally understand and make sense. Right. So it might be slightly different, you know, whenever you get in there in November and everything's off the trees or whatever, but it seems like trees are holding leaves longer and longer than I can remember whenever I was a kid growing up. So again, around PA, when I'm hunting most of the time, you know, is that, you know, middle of October timeframe where I still have a fair amount of foliage on the trees around here. Like they haven't usually dropped yet completely. And so my wind mapping that I'm able to do like over the summer when I'm scouting and stuff like that holds pretty true whenever I get into, when I get into October. November, it might change a little bit, especially if I'm in an area that's super dense and maybe it's like maybe I'm sitting on the edge of like a cut or something like that, or close to an edge of a cut where it's going to be like a big change, because it's going to go from having foliage into an open area to now like there's no foliage on the trees into an open area. So now, you know, that I guess rollback effect, you know, or a rip current, if you will, isn't quite as strong near that edge as it may have been earlier in the season. But essentially, when I'm scouting, I always carry milkweed in my bino harness. And when I stop at a spot, especially whenever I get to kind of big community scrapes and stuff like that, I want to check the wind on that prevailing while I'm there to understand what's happening and how a deer can maybe scent check that without getting, you know, super close to the scrape. That way you're not necessarily always having to hunt on the scrape and kind of get an idea of what's happening. And then every time I visit it to check a trail camera or whatever, and it might take me a couple seasons to do it, because especially those types of areas, I try to stay out of as much as possible and run cell cameras on those, so I'm not, you know, stinking the place up with my scent and stuff like that, and just make as few visits as possible. So it might take me two seasons of scouting and hunting it to wind map it to get all the different prevailing winds. Once you get like a handful of prevailing winds, you can kind of start to predict a little bit what the other winds are going to do, because you'll get a good sense of like how much influence the thermals have there. You know, I take notes, you know, in whatever app, you know, you happen to use. I use Spartan Forge, so I just kind of log my pin for my camera or like the tree setup or whatever. And every time I visit that spot, I just go into the journal and I write down what the prevailing is, and I write down what my milkweed is doing, and I can get a really good sense of what's happening. That place I was just talking about over that scrape with the signpost rub, the reason I hunted that last year is because the wind was wrong for the place that I really wanted to be. And it was in that time frame of, you know, the October lull that I really liked, that I was like, man, it sucks that the wind isn't right for, you know, one of the other places I wanted to really hunt. I was like, well, let's just go hunt this spot. I wind mapped it whenever I was back the last time. When I found it, you know, I need to go back and kind of check it out and see if, you know, that holds true. And so I went back and, you know, got into a tree, and, you know, it was a south wind, I think, that day. I get a lot of south here, south and southwest. And when I got into the tree and I'm dropping milkweed, like it was blowing north. And so a south or southwest, anything with a south in that spot is gonna blow north, which I thought was really bad for my setup, but it happened to be the right wind for that setup. And I wouldn't have known that unless I walked in there and just hunted it that day and then just continued to wind map. So now I know, you know, if I get a north wind, typically you'd look at it and go, oh, that would be great for that spot. It's like, well, no, that's the wrong wind for that spot because it's actually going to blow south in that spot. So it's just, it's, you have to spend time in some of those places to kind of understand what's going to happen. And then I mark that on my, you know, in my app. And then I know whenever I'm looking at my weather, you know, that I'm have, you know, this wind direction or whatever the case is, I have a better idea of what I'm actually going to get into those, in those particular areas.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about how deer move on a wind shift. Like, you know, like you mentioned, north versus south. Let's just, north wind, they shift, south wind. Now, you read a lot of articles or you hear people talk about, you know, deer just completely move areas on a wind shift. Mm-hmm. That's not what I witness, right? Yeah, They're still going through the same terrain features, just in a different way, right? Mm-hmm. To put themselves in the best position for that wind shift. How do you, I'll talk a little bit about what I do, but how do you shift with that wind in the same location because there's hot sign there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I haven't seen it as drastic as what some people kind of talk about either. I think that there's, I think depending on where you're at, there's different reasons for that. You know, I think you might get a little bit more of a truer, you know, wind shift in areas where, you know, I'll give an example. Like in hill country, I could see it really being prevalent there because whenever you get that wind shift, that bed might be completely hot garbage.
Yeah, the bed. Yeah. Like I agree with you there. Like I think when on a wind shift, the bedding location will definitely change, but not necessarily the movement per se.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, I think to build on that point, I think a lot of times where a deer is bedding whenever they wind shift, I don't necessarily think that they're traveling like another ridge over for a better bed. I mean, because that, especially in daylight, because what's more dangerous to them if you think about it, right?
Yeah.
Is it more dangerous to just to slightly give up the wind a little bit and shift around this knob or over to this other, you know, high point in a swamp that's maybe 30 yards away to have a little bit better of a wind advantage? Or is that safer? Or is it safer to walk in broad daylight through a saddle, a ridge away to go have a better bedding opportunity?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I think when we talk about wind shifts, I think, you know, depending on where you're hunting, you know, will kind of dictate how drastic they are potentially. And I think also the amount of pressure, because I think deer, you know, they're ultimately, they want to survive, right? And so if they have a safe path of travel and it's historically been safe, I don't know that they are as concerned with having the wind in that particular terrain feature. You know, how many times have we seen deer come through an area tailwinding, crosswinding, wind directly in their face? I mean, you hear about it all the time. And so I think the wind, that it's, you know, critically important for them to survive. But I think there's places where they allow for a less than optimal wind because that area is just well known to them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you always hear guys talk about, like, especially, you know, that I got away with a little bit of boogery with this one deer I was hunting last year. I was pretty well undetected, but I was really in close to an area that he was obviously super comfortable. I mean, he was bedding in the scrape. Like, and it was out in the open. Like there wasn't a reason why, I mean, it was close to cover, but he was really laying down in the middle of this scrape with nothing really around him. Right. And so, and you know, I'm looking at the wind whenever I got the trail camera videos and stuff like that. And like the wind was wrong for him to be quote unquote wrong. Right. For him to be in that, to just lay down in that scrape for 35 minutes, you know, but what that says to me is like, man, he is so comfortable in that spot. That's his spot. Like, he knows it inside and out. And he feels as though if there's anything amiss, he'll know about it well in advance.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's one of those things where you have to kind of take the, if you know the deer that you're hunting, you have to take into consideration their personality and what's their comfort level in a given area. I think that also will kind of help determine how much a wind shift is going to affect them, or potentially not, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I love these conversations, because just when we think we have it figured out, another deer comes along and
does the exact opposite.
Yeah, exactly. Does the exact opposite of what we, dude, I swear to God, there was a buck, I think it was 3 years ago, that every deer, let's see, let me get my bearings straight. He was coming. Okay. So on an east wind, this is, you know, it's the standard, you know, wind coming off the top, going down into a bottom, and the wind or the deer didn't have to skyline themselves at all. They could catch all the scent coming off of the top. They were working that military crest, right? You know, the, that yep. There's a trail right there, and all that, I have a trail camera, and all the deer were coming, were moving on an east wind, southeast wind, northeast wind. They're coming through this little area. Sure enough, I look at this trail camera and I'm thinking about taking it down because there's no shooters on it. And so I say, well, there's a couple odd winds coming. And you would think an odd wind would be an east wind. But I was like, okay, let me just keep it up a little bit more. And sure enough, I let it soak for another 3 weeks before I went and checked it again. And then we had these west, like a consistent west wind for like two straight weeks this summer. And sure enough, here this big mature buck shows up from, I think it was like a year ago or 2 years ago. And I was like, are you kidding me? This, like, he's doing the exact opposite that all these other deer are doing. Now, he didn't stick around during the hunting season, but it just kind of goes to show you that these deer, like, especially when everybody thinks that deer use the wind, like they're using their nose as a defense mechanism, don't get me wrong, but they're not walking head into the wind every step they take, right? And it could be quartering, it could be right at their back. And it just, I don't know, it just kind of blows my mind, especially in the rut where they're so stupid. They give up a lot to chase ass, basically.
Exactly, man. I mean, yeah, there's a spot that I found a couple years ago that I really like. Again, there's a big community scrape in this particular spot, and it's close to some water, and it's really interesting because there were three decent deer in that particular area that I would consider mature for PA public land. They were 3.5 years, 3.5 year olds or older, right? There were two that were like 3.5 and one that I was guesstimating that he was probably 4.5. And it was interesting because on the same, like, so I was getting some intel on these deer via, you know, cell camera, and kind of was watching them. And they were, and two of them were always coming from like the same direction. I'm looking at the wind and I'm like, okay, this is how they're coming in, right? And so fast forward to this year, and I kind of had it like, I hunted it a little bit last year, but really kind of watched it from afar to learn what was going on. And I thought I had a really good beat on these deer. And so I kind of knew what wind I needed to hunt. And I kind of knew what direction they would be traveling from based on that wind, right? So I hop in there this year, and I want to say it was like October, it was either the 16th or the 18th. I can't remember what that Saturday was, and hop in the tree, and I saw a couple deer, you know, earlier in the day. And this is one of those things where it's like, even that time of year, it's like when I'm going in, like I'm going to do an all day hunt, you know, in this spot. And so I get in there, and the water kind of helps you out with some thermal pool, like back toward the water and stuff like that. And I kind of knew that, and I'm expecting all the deer to basically come from my east. Right. Cause that's where I'd seen those shooters coming from to kind of check this scrape on this particular wind. Right. And while I'm sitting there, I saw a couple of deer kind of come from the general area that I thought they would come from. And then I'm about 3 o'clock, it starts to mist a little bit. And out of the corner of my eye, I catch some movement and I look, and there were two kind of like mainframe eights that were in this spot. And one was a 4.5 year old and one was probably 3.5. And the 4.5 year old was clearly bigger. They had the same exact frame, only the older deer had slightly longer tines, and that was the one I wanted to kill. And it took me a second to figure out that it was him. And long story short was I didn't get drawn in time. By the time I figured out it was the right deer, I was kind of stuck out in no man's land. But what really screwed me up on that was that deer, I saw him on camera one time and I knew he was in there. The next time I saw him, he came in on that wind that all the other deer were using the opposite direction. He came in the opposite way, completely backwards to what every other deer was using the wind in that spot. If he comes from that spot if he uses the wind the same way that all the other deer were using the wind, I see him well in advance and he gets an arrow, like no doubt, no yeah. problem. It was just the area that he came from. I had a lot less breakup and I had to make a lot quicker of a decision on whether or not it's like that was a deer I was going to kill. And it was all because he was using the wind completely opposite of every other deer that I saw. I wasn't really even paying attention to that area. I mean, I was, but it wasn't like I wasn't concentrating on that area.
Yeah.
You know, if I had to put a percentage on it, I would have said there was maybe a 20% chance the deer that I wanted to shoot was going to come from that area, because he would basically be giving up the wind coming in on that direction.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think you got distracted by the other deer and you weren't like checking your six when he came in and
100%.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Like, I've been there, man. That sucks.
Yeah. I was concentrating on where I had seen deer coming from. So I'm like, okay, everything I thought about this spot is true. Like, I'm watching the activity around me and this is where all the deer are coming from my east. Right. Yeah. So I'm like, this is where I need to kind of focus my attention. And that was kind of the priority. I mean, I did the normal scan around as you do when you're hunting, just to kind of check everything out or whatever, move slowly. And it was just, there was no reason for me to look to my left. I mean, it wasn't like he made a noise because it was damp. There was a bunch of swamp grass in there. So it was all kind of dying down. So it was all yellow and made like a nice soft bed to kind of walk across. So it wasn't like he was making any noise. I just happened to, it was the time to check to my left.
Yeah, right. You know? Yeah.
And he just happened to be there at like 30 yards or whatever and was coming.
What time of year was that?
It was either October 16th or the 18th.
Okay. So still early for the most part. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm telling you, man, like the older a buck gets, the less they like other deer, except when they're trying to breed. Like they just, like for me, they stay away and then they just pop up out of nowhere. And they may have been there the whole time, but they're, I don't know, man, they're just on a different, they're on a different level, right? And they don't like being around deer. One of the best examples I've ever seen of this is it was a buck that I had chased for several years. He pops out of this thicket and he could have done what he came from where the other deer came from. They crossed a very small little ditch. They popped up. They went through my shooting lanes. If this buck would have done the same thing, 22, 23 yard shot broadside, I would have, you know, just maybe I would have had him on the ground, right?
Right.
But these does, small bucks, came through. He stopped, and the wind was in his favor at this point, and he's just scent checking every single deer that walked through, and then he takes a hard right. He stays in the thick, nasty shit and just walks out of my life for that year. And so they know, right? They don't need to go – they don't need to be – like they can smell other deer and go, nah, she's not ready. I'm not ready. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. And then that's how they just stay hidden all the time. And that's why nobody has a ton of experience with a very calm, non-rutted buck, because they just aren't out there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, unless you know where it's, you know, he's laying his head and you
exactly.
can kind of like that circle of his comfort zone where he's going to, I don't want to say not be on guard, but he's going to have a level of comfort that's going to allow him to be a little bit more relaxed.
Right.
And I just find, like, you know, the encounters that I've had with mature deer, especially around here on, you know, as much pressure as we get around here, it's like, man, they're keyed up and on point. So that deer that came in the opposite direction, I had thought, like, by the time I recognized what deer it was, he was at 18 yards and took a handful of more steps. And now he cleared the last piece of brush that I had as cover to get drawn. So I was stuck out in no man's land. I could not. I was praying for a squirrel to bark on the other side of me.
Just so he could turn his head.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, and it just wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
And he saw me, you know, in the tree at that point. And then it was weird. He didn't spook hard. He didn't blow. He took two big bounds and got maybe you know, to 30 yards and just stopped again and looked back and then just walked away out of my life. But the thing was, like, never again was did I see that deer in terms of, like, on the hoof, yeah. right? And never again did I see him on truck camera the rest of the year. Yeah. Like, so he just became a phantom after that. But the cool thing about that particular spot was, so for 2 years I've watched it and kind of and hunted it, but very strategically, just on specific dates. I do a lot more hunting around specific dates than I do almost anything else.
Yeah.
I pay attention to weather, of course, and stuff like that, but I really kind of learn what dates are going to work for me in and around kind of primary, you know, community scrape areas.
Yeah.
And this spot here particularly has always been like the most mature deer that is in that general area that's going to call that area home for the fall and for the rut. It's weird because these bucks usually use this area up until about the very beginning of the first week of November, and then they disappear. Like, then they're kind of gone.
Yeah.
Like, I don't usually see them any longer. But it's usually kind of what I was guesstimating from my trail camera data was, like, you know, and what I'd seen just in terms of encounters was usually like that, like 13th roughly through like the 18th or maybe the 20th. Like, I typically was going to get the most mature deer in that area that's going to call that area his fall range or his rut range. He will daylight and show himself and make himself killable usually one time in within that like 5 to 6 day window, right? That's the first time I'll see him in daylight. And so I've kind of, that's kind of how I had that encounter this year, but it's still just based on trail camera data. So you're just kind of curious, like, am I just getting lucky in those time frames? Like, yeah, I've got a couple years worth of data, but is it still just happenstance? So this year I was watching, cause I leave a camera up on that spot all year round. And this year I saw the first fawn drop and like a doe with a fawn came out. And whenever I backdated that based on, like, you know, subtract like 2 or 3 days off the date that you saw her, because it takes a couple of days for them to kind of get up and get mobile enough for mom to take them out, you know, and then backdate that 200 days from that day, you know, essentially where it was landing was October 15th is when that doe would have had to have been bred.
No shit. So, early.
Yeah. So my trail camera data was correct. So sometime in that week between the 15th and 20th is when a doe is going to get warm and come into estrus in that area.
Yeah.
And which is, I mean, it was awesome because it just kind of confirmed everything I had been seeing on trail camera for 2 years and everything I'd been observing while I was hunting, because I knew that that spot always was early. And now I just got confirmation. Well, it's because that doe is coming in. And the awesome thing is that those does that are in that doe family are all going to share that estrus date. So as long as those does remain alive in that area, that spot's going to turn on that time of year every year.
Yeah, man. I wish I had a early season, like a late October doe group that went in. Most of mine are in that 5th through 10th time frame, like your typical, right. You know, I don't know, it's earlier, it's early on the peak, but mm-hmm. as far as, you know, the 14th of November being the peak, it's before that. And so yeah. the first 5 days of November on the farms that I hunt really suck. I mean, they're not, there's not much movement, but then things start to happen on the 5th through the, you know, 18th in that time frame. So,
right.
I have one more question for you. All right.
Cool.
I'm really close. Like, there's a boat. It's a John boat for sale. And mm-hmm. I am considering buying it for one reason, two reasons. One, to run bank poles on the river, to catch catfish. Mm-hmm. Two, water access. Should I buy the boat?
100% yes.
Like, shut up.
Yeah, man. There's, you know, I have some water access around me where I live, and it is some of my most prime spots. And it's not even that it's like the best spot that you would walk into and think like, man, this is going to be great deer hunting. It's just for no other reason that it's the thickest, nastiest, shittiest spot in and around that area that you don't want to walk to it. And if you do, you're going to blow every deer out within like a 3 mile radius. And the only way to hunt it effectively is to go in on the water.
Yeah.
And just a lot of guys aren't doing it. Some guys will do it. Right. And that's fine. But you know, you can find a lot more honey holes that way. The other part too, is especially whenever I go out of state, like that's one of the things I always kind of look for. If the area that I'm going to, if that's applicable, right? Like, so, you know, if I can find a spot that has water or a lake or something like that, it's like, I kind of prefer that. And then just use a boat for access, because you cut out a lot of your headache in terms of pressure by using the boat. The spot I hunted in Missouri, it wasn't a big spot, and it wasn't real obvious on a map either. And the thing about it is that it's not a ton of huntable acreage necessarily, but there is a lake, and if you want to hunt it effectively, you really need a boat. Otherwise, you've got a lot of long hikes around the edge of this lake just based on where you can park and where the access is.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Chad and I were there together. I saw, I mean, it was the last spot we stopped in Missouri because we traveled to three different spots and three different pieces of public in like 6 days. And we showed up, just called on a Friday in the afternoon after we left the previous spot, drove a couple hours, got this spot, set up the trailer, and walked in. And within being there for, I don't even know, man, probably 3 hours, I saw a 150-inch deer that I almost got run over by. I was taking a leak, and these deer came busting out of this thicket, this cedar thicket, and a buck was chasing a doe, and it was a giant, and almost ran me over. Like, I could have reached out while I was taking a leak and just, like, rodeoed him and grabbed him by his antlers. He ran by me that close.
Dang.
Yeah. It was actually kind of frightening for a moment because I thought I was legitimately going to get run over. And then,
especially with your pants down.
Yeah, I mean, I literally had the junk in my hand. Like, as it ran by. They got the full on frontal, both of those deer. And then Chad on the other side of this water, he ended up missing like a 130, and it was within both of us within 2 hours of just getting on dry land.
Yeah.
And then the next day he saw, well, he actually, as soon as he got on dry land, he actually ended up jumping like 160-inch deer, like within a half hour.
Yeah.
And then I ended up hitting one and losing it the next day. And then Chad ended up seeing that, like, you know, mid 130s again the following day, and just didn't get a shot opportunity. So we were there for literally 36 hours and had like four encounters. Two of those encounters were with the 150 to 160 inch deer.
Dang.
And it's just a little honey hole that holds really great deer. Like, I knew from some locals that we talked to that there's a particular part of this area that no one really hunts it during bow season, but gun season it does get hunted. And they'll pull like a handful of Boone and Crockett deer out of it every year.
No shit.
Yeah. And so it's kind of like my little honey hole that I kind of know about. And you can't hunt it if you're not going to use a boat, you know? And so for me, it's like, I would like to get a John boat because that's a spot where I probably wouldn't trust my kayak that I use. I use a kayak around here in a lot of places, but that's a spot there where the water was large enough that I don't know that I would trust my kayak to kind of get around.
Yeah. Ugh. All right. I guess I got to buy a boat now.
John boat is in your future, my friend.
That's right. All right. Well, hey, dude, we've been chatting and talking for over an hour now. Clint, man, really appreciate you taking time out of your day to sit here and BS with us. Thanks, man. And good luck this upcoming season.
Back at you, brother. Glad your family's well. Glad your wife is healing up and everything's good on that front. And good luck this upcoming season.